Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
All right, well, good morning and welcome to Firehouse.com here, where we're going to be speaking today on Firehouse webcast. We're going to be talking about engine company operations, and today we have with us from New Jersey, Jersey City, Deputy Chief Butch Cobb, and from Fairfax County, Virginia, we have Battalion Chief Al Mullins, and from Charleston, West Virginia, we have Firefighter Ryan Pennington, and I'll be hosting here today with them, and my name is Russ Merrick, and I'm a captain with the Rochester, New York Fire Department. So we'd like to welcome everybody here today, and we'll just do a little round-robin introduction. Again, my name is Russ Merrick. I'm from the Rochester Fire Department in New York. Currently the captain and station commander for a truck company. I've got 23 years with the Rochester Fire Department and a little over 30 years altogether with the volunteer service that I did prior to coming into the career side of it. Basically, my background, I've worked in several areas in the fire service, staff positions from safety officer to special operations to training academy, and back on the line with the truck company now. And also, I teach for the local community college in their fire protection technology program. So it's a little bit about myself. Deputy Chief Cobb.
Thanks, Russ. I started my career in 1970 with the Dumont Volunteer Fire Department, and became a career firefighter in 1972. Just recently retired from the Jersey City Fire Department in December after 35 plus years. Also a volunteer fire department. Was a member of the Volunteer Fire Department in West Milford Township up in northern New Jersey. Where I currently live, spent a great deal of my career on engine companies, both in volunteer and in my career department. After retiring, I just recently took a position with the insurance services offices in New Jersey, ISO, as everybody knows them. And just so everybody knows, the comments and opinions that I give on today's podcast are just all my personal observations and personal comments, and are not those of ISO. So I'm glad to be here, Russ, and looking forward to our discussion.
Great, thanks. And Chief Mullins.
My name is Al Mullins. I'm a battalion chief with Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department. I'm currently in my 28th year with Fairfax County. I've worked in several different divisions within the department. I've been in training. I've been in operations probably predominant portion of my career. I've also done some work in the fire prevention division as far as inspections and systems testing. I've also been a volunteer firefighter. I started as a volunteer firefighter in upstate New York in 1977 in a small town called Yulin. And I've probably worked on just about every type of fire apparatus there is in Fairfax County. And I was fortunate enough to be part of the response to the Pentagon on 9/11, and certainly that's an aspect that I'm pretty proud of.
Yeah, anybody who worked with the incidents, I know that Chief Cobb, he worked with the FDNY there during their 9/11 catastrophe as well. So, yeah, it was a sad day in America's history with the fire service, no doubt. And Ryan.
Oh, thanks, Russ, and thanks for having me on the panel today. My name is Ryan Pennington. I'm currently a firefighter paramedic for the city of Charleston in Charleston, West Virginia. I've been with them for about 3 years. My fire service career has spanned 15 years through EMS and fire. I'm currently assigned to Engine 457 on the west side of Charleston. I'm also a West Virginia fire instructor, and I teach through the RESA division of West Virginia Education in the Charleston area. And I'd like to thank you guys for inviting me.
Okay, well, we hope that today, as you can see, our panel is made up of a lot of experience, and we're right on through the ranks from firefighters to company officers through battalion chiefs right up to the deputy and division chiefs here. So there's a lot of experience being brought to you here today, as well as a lot of knowledge. So we hope that some of the stuff that we're going to be able to cover here this morning will give you a lot more background to help you make some of the decisions and choices that you may have to make in your departments. So first of all, we have a few questions that were drawn up here for us, and the first question we want to look at is the departments around the country are closing companies and cutting back on their staffs more and more. Some of the urban engine companies are now rolling out the doors with just two members on them, and second due companies are being closed down for the day for several reasons, maybe training or lack of manpower for the day. Try and look at what are some of the new priorities that we as commanders and officers and firefighters in the fire service may have to deal with these particular incidents that are occurring. And I'd like to start out with Chief Mullins.
Well, you know, we're looking at that. We're looking at two members rolling out on a piece of apparatus to go to a fire situation. And, you know, just looking at that, looking at the OSHA standards that are out there as far as two in, two out goes, if I only have two people showing up on an engine company, I cannot start and sustain offensive fire operations, because obviously I'm going to need at least two more people on the scene for the inside-outside aspect, just in case that inside team gets into trouble. So, you know, we're putting ourselves well behind the eight ball by only having two people on the engine companies.
And you bring up a good point there, too, because I know that when we talk here, we're all on the career side of things, and we're not just focusing on our problems dealing with career sites, because there's many volunteer departments out there across the country, and they're facing the same issues that we're facing. And in some cases, they're even being hit harder than what we are. However, you bring up a good point there with the two-in, two-out ruling, where we have to have two firefighters presuming a RIC position before we can make entry into most of the situations that we get into. And on the career side, I know that's very restrictive on a lot of us, because a lot of fires that we could probably get a quick knockdown on, sometimes they're getting away from us just because we don't have sufficient staffing there. And it's the same for the volunteers. Sometimes they're rolling out the door with just a driver on there. They're fortunate enough that they've got somebody to get the truck on the road, and they're hurting until people show up in their own private vehicles. So some of the rules, some of the regulations that we have out there are for our safety and health, and they're great to have. Unfortunately, sometimes they are restricting us. But, again, we face tragedies every day. Firefighting is not the safest job in the world, as we see. Our numbers are still high. Recently, for this year, we're already up to 59 fatalities in the fire service. So definitely some of the cutbacks here are really going to be focusing on our behalf to maybe make changes that we really don't want to do. Chief Cobb?
Well, in looking at at this problem, this is a problem that goes on both sides of the fence, whether your career department or your volunteer department. And a couple of things that I look at, and now especially since I get to travel a lot more, to look at fire departments across the country, I'm really getting a better view of the American Fire Service as a whole. And you know, coming from the Northeast, you know, we have a lot of truck companies, so we don't worry about, if you're on an engine, about the ventilation and the search and rescue. But there are a lot of departments. My volley department, for one, we have an engine, we have an engine tanker. So when we respond out to an incident, if there are only two people on board, I have to wonder, who does the ventilation? If you're a career department and you're rolling out with two guys on an engine and a service truck or a ladder truck's coming from several miles away, or maybe one's not coming at all, or maybe the second new engine's been browned out or blacked out, where's that manpower coming to do the things like ventilation, forcible entry? Who's doing the search and rescue if it's a two-man engine company? The other thing is, I was glad to see that a lot of departments now are pulling up to a fire, a well-involved building, and they're getting away from the inch and three-quarter line. They're going to a bigger line. I see some departments now have two-inch attack lines. some departments now, they decided we need a maximum amount of water for this incident. Let's grab the 2.5. Let's not stay with the little line. Two-man engine company shows up. What choices the first two captain have? He gets a well-involved house fire, possibly into an exposure. He doesn't have a choice to have a 2.5. His only option is 1.75 inches till more people get there. So now the fire gets bigger, gets more dangerous for the rest of us. And the other thing that really bothers me about reducing the manpower in a company, you know, I know the fire service. I know when we get there, whether we have 2, 3, or 4, we are going to do as many tasks as possible. And when you show up with a two-man engine company, the first thing that comes into my mind is freelancing. We're going to split up. One line's going to go here, the other line's going to go there. And I think the fire service has done a really good job, you know, over the last 5, 6, 8 years in cutting down on freelancing, because that just leads to a lot of trouble and firefighter death. So, and one of the key things for me is I know what we do. We're going to do as much as we can do when we get there. And unfortunately, some guys are going to split up and say, you know what, you do the first floor, I'm going to do the second floor. And you know what, when we increase manpower like that, I think for all we do to help bring down that number of firefighters killed on the fire ground, I think this is one of the things that might bring it headed back up again. So,
you bring up a good point there, Chief, in mentioning the fact that when we do cut back, the work still needs to be done. And as firefighters, that's one thing that we've always taken pride in, is that whatever it takes, we're going to do. And you're right. We do see firefighters on the fire ground doing more than what they probably ought to be doing, and they're putting themselves now in more jeopardy and more harm because they have extended themselves to where maybe they're working in an unsafe condition, or they're taking doing more after they've already done so much and they're fatigued, and they ought to probably be taking a break, that they are now stressing themselves to the point where, yeah, they are subjecting themselves to maybe a heart attack or something on the fire ground, which is one of the leading causes of the firefighter fatalities. So it is a concern. It should be a concern with not just ourselves as company officers, as chief officers, and as firefighters, but it should be something that as a community, our community leaders should be concerned about as well. Ryan, how would you address it? Being a firefighter, I know that you don't see as much as maybe the chief officers on the fire ground are, or as much as maybe your company officer, but you are directly affected by it because you're one of the firefighters that we're asking to do more with less, actually.
Thanks, Russ. The original department that I got hired as a career guy actually runs with two guys on a company, so I'm quite familiar with the situation. It puts a real burden upon your firefighter, because that officer's arriving on that first 2 inch, and he's responsible for everything, the water supply, the size up. My aspect as a firefighter is my skills have to be that much better because I have to do so much more. I can't wait 10 minutes to hook the Storz fittings up. I have to be able to do it in 30 seconds. I have to be able to get the initial attack line stretched and ready for the next companies coming in. So I was always trying to be ahead of the game, being prepared for the men to be showing up. The problem in which lies that is if you pull into a scene and there is a life safety issue, there is an entrapment into the structure, it's forcing us to do stuff that we shouldn't be doing. And I myself have been forced to be in that situation more than one occasion. And the stress it puts on you is just unbelievable. Because here this person saying, that's my mother, father, brother, sister in that structure, you're the fireman, you need to go get them. So how do you handle that? As a firefighter, we're not prepared to handle that type of a situation. It just puts an undeal amount of stress. So handling this company situation is the way we did it where we came from was early mutual aid often, actually signing automatic aid agreements. But the terrain in which we live in, I was just talking to the chief earlier that the terrain slowed your response so much because we're a hilly type of region. So you're looking at 5 to 10 minutes of self-sustaining. So my best advice to a firefighter is keep honing your skills, know your job, know your equipment, know the location, know your territory, so that the ways that you can save time and help be better prepared is better preparation for yourself. Be better prepared to support your officers in everything that you do.
You bring up a good point, Ryan, in that you're saying that as a firefighter, you're being stressed more now because you actually are taking on some of the roles and responsibilities of maybe the company officer, because now you're doing more worrying about different things going on that fire ground in that incident scene than maybe you should be in. You're taking your focus off of what your job is as far as getting the line in place or stretching the line or making the hydrant on the way in, and you're now focusing on some of the things that maybe the company officer is also focusing in on. So you're putting a lot more stress on yourself because of that lack of help and assistance. That's a good point. Chief, what is your feeling on that?
I think that's a really good point because with that many people, you know, there's certain obvious tactics and tasks that need to be taken care of on the scene. The RECVS, I don't care how old it gets, you know, Lloyd Lehman came up with that in the 30s or so, and that still is pretty prevalent today, and you still have to do those same tactics and tasks in order to get into the building, put the fire out, and rescue the people. And I think that the point you made about rescue is one that really needs to be brought out, because rescue obviously is one of those little caveats in the two in, two out, where you do have the ability to kind of waive the two in, two out rule and go in and try and perform the rescue. And, you know, obviously a good size up is really important, but still, if you only have two guys, one person's going to do the size up, the other person's going to start to get ready to initiate the rescue. And, you know, just thinking about accountability and stuff, that's going to be real difficult to maintain a good accountability on the incident scene if one person goes in and the other person's not too sure where they went and how they got into the building. So, you know, there's a lot of tasks that still need to be accomplished. We just, you know, we're looking at putting a whole lot of stress on a lot fewer people. You know, fortunately, I'm in a position where I have a pretty good staffing, but we go right across the river into another county, and, you know, they're not so fortunate. So we end up going over there and picking up a lot of activity.
Yeah, and I might add, as a company officer, I also now find myself doing more tasks than I should be doing, because as a company officer, I've always felt that my role and responsibility is to oversee my firefighters and maintain their safety and awareness as what's going around in the environment that we're in, because as a firefighter's dragging and stretching lines and moving in and everything, they're focusing on where they're going and what they're doing with that line and trying to find the seat of the fire. Myself, I'm looking around, make sure we don't have fire coming around behind us or rolling over us, and trying to keep the crew safe. As a company officer, I feel that was my job. Now I find myself doing more of the hands-on, helping hump the hose, maybe forcing the door to get the hose into position and stuff. And once we're inside, helping maneuver the line to get it into position as well, and I'm not really paying as much attention to the surroundings as I should be. So, again, we're finding we're putting ourselves and our crews more in harm's way because everybody's doing more with less.
Yeah. Chief Plus, Cobb, you look at the effectiveness of putting a line in service with only two people, and I know
it is tough.
Chief Cobb talked about the 2.5, and that's a good thought process, but, you know, that 2.5 line, that's just not something that you can maneuver into a single family detached very easily.
And there's a lot of people, you're absolutely right, there's a lot of fire departments today that they don't have the adequate staffing or firefighters showing up in a timely fashion. If you're in a volunteer department, I mean, some volunteer departments, they get great turnouts. But again, when you're showing up in your privately owned vehicle, you may be coming from 3 miles or 4 miles away, so the timing isn't like you're all getting there at the same time and putting your plan together and having it work effectively. It's being piecemealed in. It's one of the things that I see also on several incidences where instead of calling for a second alarm or a third alarm, we piecemeal an apparatus, and, you know, that's just – that in my mindset, and again, it's like the Chief Cobb said, these are my opinions, and, you know, I'd much rather call for another alarm and turn units away or stage them as to be piecemealing and piecemealing and piecemealing, because then you're never playing.
You get behind the curve, you never get in front of the curve.
Exactly right. We're always behind and never ahead.
I could agree more than what all three of you said. One of the programs that I do here for Firehouse is based on the first two company officers' assessment of what he has. I throw a great importance on that first two company officer when he shows up. And if you're a three- or four-man company, the officer has the opportunity to get there, recognize what he has, determine what his strategy is going to be. Are we going to wait for more manpower before we go in, or is this an outside operation? And then he can, if he decides he's going to go in, he can, in his mind, very quickly determine what his tactics are going to be to do that, while there's two or three firefighters, set up the line that he wants, start to advance it to where he decided. But when you get down to a two-person or a limited manpower crew, the officer doesn't get a chance to do that because he gets involved with the tactics. And you know what? He no longer supervises.
Exactly
so
right.
Now you have an unsupervised company going in. It may force him, or it may make his decision process that, you know what, let's run it here real quick. And in fact, he didn't have the opportunity to take a good look, and he made the wrong move. And I always say, you know what, just again from experience, if that first company officer shows up and decides we're going in to put this fire out, everybody else is going to follow him. It's very seldom that somebody shows up and says, oh, geez, you know what? When we get there, you know, we'll react. And if the first officer didn't have an opportunity to make the correct size up, I think, you know what, it's just a real recipe for something bad to happen. You know, a long time ago, a mentor of me, a deputy chief from Jersey City, who's moved on to a pretty high position in the U.S. Fire Administration, he said to me when I got promoted to captain, he came to me and he goes, your job is illumination and supervision. He says, you lead your men in there, you supervise all their activities, and you light the way for them. Now, I know what he meant by that. And if he ever saw me as a company officer touch a hose, and he'd come up and give me a little pat on the back and say, no, that's not your job.
Right.
So, you know what? But when we get down to two-person crews, I mean, you know what? How many officers can do all that, supervise their crew, and make the right judgment calls?
It's kind of like years ago when I first got into the volunteer service, one of our main tack lines was a high-pressure booster line where we steamed out the fires.
We all did that.
And yes, and one thing that I have noticed in the 30-plus years in the fire service is that the fires today that we're fighting, they're not the same fires we fought 30 years ago. The contents in housing today it's more of the plastics and synthetic materials that the fires are a lot hotter, they're moving a lot quicker, and we need the fire suppression hose lines to be able to combat that. And we've moved away from high pressure line. Now we're using primarily 1 3/4, and we'd love to have the opportunity to use the 2.5 in some places. Again, size up is an important feature. As a company officer on an engine pulling in, it's the first 5 minutes. The actions that we're taking within those first 5 minutes are going to dictate the outcome of that incident, whether we're going to be successful or whether we're going to be there for the long haul and having the parking lot constructed about a week later. Yes, Ryan.
It's funny that you mentioned the 2.5s. I would encourage all of our listeners to go out and check out the manufacturers nowadays with these new inventions they're coming out with, the new different types of nozzles. I know in West Virginia, the couple different manufacturers make these nozzles that one person can operate a 2.5. So what we're finding a lot in our area is that's our third person. If we have an exposure problem, we'll set it up almost like a water curtain or a water stream. So while the other people are initiating the fire attack, we've got our exposure almost completely covered.
Like a blitz nozzle?
Correct.
Got the manufacturer name of that other one there where you can just set them up and walk away from them.
Correct.
Yeah, we have something that's called a mercury nozzle.
Mercury nozzle.
We just take it and set it down,
right.
Apply it to the exposure. You can apply it to the building that's on fire.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of flow, and it basically it just is a standalone feature.
Right.
And it's nice because it does take a person and puts them back on the company and
but again,
lets them go to work.
But again, I'll remind everybody out there, our listening audience too, that it's just another tool in our toolbox that
yes,
we have. If
exactly.
we have it, not every department has it, but if we have one, it's another tool. It's an option that we have. And again, it's a decision that's going to have to be made, and somebody's got to make the decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Russ, one of the things I want to pass along just came to mind that we're speaking about manpower and engine company operations. I was just recently in Alberta, up in Canada, at the IAFC.
At the Metro Chiefs?
Metro section, a conference, and a couple of the speakers came from the IAFF. I believe it was, it might have been Laurie Moore from the IAFF. But one of the things that was discussed is a new report. I believe it's going to be coming out shortly. The IAF through a grant along with NIST and Montgomery County did a very, I guess the best way I can put it, a very scientific evaluation of manpower.
Yes.
Two person, three person, four, and five. And when I sat there, and they just gave us some brief details, because I'm not sure, did it come out yet? Do you know?
No, but I know we were involved in it, and it was pretty impressive because they would set fires, and they'd take the staffing, and they'd look at the different staffing levels to see just how well they could develop the fire flows and stuff. I mean, it's almost going back to what Kimball wrote about years ago in his books, but it was a much more scientific approach to it. But, yeah that I don't think it's come out yet. But
I think it's due out shortly, and they just gave us a briefing on it. But when I looked at it, and I saw the differences between 2, 3, 4, and 5, I mean, when this comes out, every fire chief out there's got to grab this, and this should be his Bible. And from what I understand, this report, again, because of the science involved in it, it's you can't shoot any holes in this. This is all very factual. They showed us some video. There were real situations, real firefighters. This is not computer generated. And it was just amazing. So, just a heads up. When this comes out, I'm sure it's going to be marketed throughout the fire service, but when it does, you got to get it, you got to look at it, and put it on your arm and walk to City Hall with it.
Okay, let's move on here. We got another question here, and I know this is one that has a great impact on our city, where I'm from, is vacant structures. In your departments, have your departments been doing anything as far as rethinking or rewriting any SOGs or SOPs as far as how we go about approaching structure fires? Again, keeping in mind that a lot of these structures are boarded up, and again, being aggressive interior firefighters is sometimes, I like to think of the vacant structure fires as a hazardous material situation where we take time, we slow down instead of speeding up, and usually at a fire scene we wanna go and we wanna act fast and quickly, we wanna get that line in place. But in a lot of these structures that are vacant and boarded up, we have transients moving in there. Some of these homes have had fires in them in the past, so we have holes in the floors, and they're opened up walls, so they're ready to go off. And with another fire in there, we could have a pretty good rapid burning and rapid paced fire and putting our guys inside there without it getting opened up thoroughly, giving them their second means of egress in the event that things go sour really quickly on them. Ryan, has your department done anything as far as the vacant structures? What are your thoughts on them?
I can only give you a perspective of my point of view as being a firefighter, but to answer your first question is yes. Our building department, which is associated with our fire department, has went and identified and passed that along information to each individual company, and it's posted upon our situational awareness board. So we're identified those risks, and there is some buildings that we know beforehand that we will not go in, period. It's too big.
And how do you identify those then? Is it just something that as a company you've had something? I know every firehouse that I go into, we have a chalkboard or a whiteboard nowadays that you have a fire hydrant out of service, it's noted on there, or if you know of any, I know we're not supposed to, I don't say that we do, but if we know of an AIDS victim or something in our jurisdiction, we usually have a little note down there that, caution entering this structure for EMS runs or whatever. Do they also mark down those types of things in your stations?
Correct, they do. Mainly it is if they've already experienced some sort of a collapse, if there's been a fire in it previously, as there's been holes in the floors, structurally unsound buildings, those will immediately be identified. And then as a firefighter, I find myself running in the EMS runs and noticing them. And also I work with a great captain who notifies them, who identifies them and says, hey guys, we're not going in there, period. That these dilapidated structures, just like Charleston, just like everywhere else around the country, they're everywhere. And the building department's done a really good job passing that information along to not only the officers, but all the way down to the firefighter level. That's where I think technology nowadays, emails are great. We get daily updates, emails. Here's this address. It is unsafe, untenable. Do not enter.
Chief Mullen?
I think we've got a pretty decent system. We put the onus on the stations to go out and take a look in their first two areas and identify structures that are vacant. Now, obviously, you're going to have the vacant structures, the you know, the large single-family detached that was just built a couple months ago, but because of the recent climate in the building market, it's not selling. But we also have buildings that have been abandoned for years, and just like you're saying, they've got the plywood on the exterior. We look to identify those, and we're pretty fortunate we've got a mobile command terminal into the vehicles, and we can put what's called a location of interest file in place. And we put those in place, and when the dispatch comes out, it brings up this information that allows us to...
Kind of like the critical incident dispatch...
It gives us additional information, so as we're en route to the fire, we can pull this additional information up, and we can make some good decisions before we even get to the incident scene. But I like what Russ was saying. You know, you go out on the EMS calls, and that's an opportune time to go out and look at these buildings. And, you know, if you've got a building in your first two, even if you're driving by it on the way back to the station, stop, take a look. If it's got boards up on it, you know, that means somebody doesn't want it anymore.
Yeah, Ryan brought up a good point there, too, about going out on EMS runs. We are running a lot more EMS, and it's usually the engine company that does EMS runs. And I try to tell my firefighters back home, this is an opportunity. And I'm getting away from the boarded up structures right now. This is an opportunity as firefighters and company officers. We're being invited into someone's home. Hmm. What a great opportunity to do a size up inside the home.
Yep.
And look and try and figure out where is the interior stairwell to the second floor. What are the conditions? Do they live like pack rats, or are they fairly clean living environment that they're in, whatever? Because chances are we may be going back there again. Might not be this week. It might not be this month. It might not be this year. But we may be going back there again in the future for a fire, and being able to have that knowledge already in the back of our minds. It's amazing what our minds can do in situations like that, how fast that recall can come back to us. But those are opportunities for us to get inside people's homes and do some looking around. I know one of the things that we're doing in our department is anytime we go in anybody's home is we check their smoke detectors while we're there to make sure that their batteries are in the smoke detectors, that the smoke detector is functional. If not, we've got a replacement program where we replace them for them. So it's just another opportunity that we have to do a size up, per se, in a non-hazardous environment.
Oh, that's a great point.
Chief Cobb, what are your thoughts? What were they doing in Jersey City with the vacants?
Well, when I first started my career in the early 70s, I sort of cut my teeth on vacant building fires. Just in the area that I worked, even back then, it was some tough, hard economic times. There were quite a few vacant buildings in the area I worked in. And, you know, back then, though, I remember the company offices. Probably the first four or five fires I went to were in vacant buildings. And they were particularly, you know what, they were just very particular about what we did. They were much more careful. But the simple fact was, as it was back in the early 70s, and right up to the time that I retired in my career department, there were people, because of the economic times, and we all know what we're going through now, there are people that are homeless and they live in vacant buildings. Should we go into them? You know what? It'd be tough to say no. Don't go into any vacant buildings. But you know what? I just, in all my years in Jersey City, we knew some of the people that lived there. And this was a very spirited discussion we had on the same topic up at the New York State Chiefs Conference just recently. We had a panel, and that came up. And one side said, you know, vacant building, border, don't go in at all. Mm-hmm. Just stay outside. You know, and then myself and a couple of other guys, my friend Johnny Salka was there, and they were talking about searching. And is there anybody in there? And a real simple way... That John put it, and I agree with him. As an incident commander outside, I don't know if everybody's out of that building, whether it's vacant or not, unless my guys go in and call me on the radio and say there's nobody in here. Now, how do you go about that? Well, one of the things that we started in Jersey City was a very, very effective and robust system of going out, having the company office inspect the buildings, look at the buildings, write everything up, and then we have a marking system. Sometimes we just every fire truck in Jersey City has a can of orange spray paint, luminous, the stuff that lights up in the dark, and they go in and they do their write up. They get together with the battalion chief, with the rest of the companies of the battalion, and they mark it with the square and the X. The stairs are out, the roof's open. If the X is through it, it means you don't go in under any circumstances. So as soon as you get there, you could use that. And we either put it on the building or we put a piece of plywood up if it's still open, and we mark it. It goes into our CAD information. So you get all that going in. And then when you get there, you know, depending on your departments, some departments, a small department, they may know for a fact that nobody's in there. When you have a lot of vacant buildings, you just don't know.
Right. So in today's economy, we are finding a lot more homeless people, a lot more people that are losing their apartments, losing their homes, and they are just...
Some of the holidays, we would do what we could with the city to get these people moved out. But you know what? Some of the people had been there so long that, you know, we would bring them food, we'd bring them clothes. We knew we were in there. So do we attack a vacant building fire like we would do an occupied structure in somebody's raised ranch house? Absolutely not. But I think as a blanket statement, I don't think you can say we have to stay out of vacant buildings. I couldn't agree with that blanket statement.
That's a tough call, and it's going to be the call of that first due engine company pulling up to the scene. Do they see something out of the ordinary? Maybe they see an open window on the second floor. Everything else is boarded up. Maybe that is the point of entry for a transient. Maybe there is a door that's been pried open on the first floor or some plywood that's been pulled back. Again, a size up is a process that we have to do a lot of thought process. Things are going through our minds. What if, what if, what if? And again, I know in our department we've got it's not a set in stone policy that we're not going in, but it's... we're going to slow down a lot more before we just jump in there to run through a vacant boarded up structure to do a search. But we're going to get in, and you know, we'll get the boards all off the first floor at least, and get our guys moving then. But until we start getting some boards off the windows, it's tough to throw firefighters in those situations, because again, firefighting is dangerous, and we're killing a lot of people. We're trying to figure out today.
If you look at that, you go back to Atlanta, I think it was last year, and they had that very same situation occur in which they lost the life of a firefighter. It's a board-up structure, probably, less than 1,000 square foot, single-family detached. It's in an area that they know is obviously a heavy drug use area, but the house was boarded up. The company gets in, and I don't remember exactly how they got in, but they got in. They didn't have all the plywood taken off the windows and stuff. The crew got overwhelmed by the fire, and everybody got out except one of the firefighters, and he ended up dying in that building. So, I mean, that's a perfect case, a perfect example of why you need to be really careful with that.
I think one of the things that we in the fire service have to do, especially the chief officers, is get together with the community officials. You know, and if you have a vacant building that is so bad that the fire department can't go in, you need to get it torn down.
Exactly.
I think that's
right.
A key thing. Massachusetts started that. After the tragic fire in 1999 in Worcester, the fire service up there and the Worcester guys went to the legislature, and they have some pretty hard laws now on vacant buildings for being boarded up, and if they're in disrepair after a certain amount, they have to come down. So I think
we have the same policy in Rochester, but again, funding only goes so far, and how many vacant structures can we take down? We're not going to be able to get them all down, but we're going to get the worst of them down. Mm-hmm. It brings up another point. We talk about not just boarded up structures with plywood, but there's this new process they've got out there. We've been seeing some of it popping up from time to time. They're using this new steel-like grading and everything that's going on. In Pittsburgh, it had a problem with it, and where realtors are using it to board up buildings that are still in good shape and everything, and once you get in there, if you don't have the mechanisms and the or the whereabouts or the knowledge of this stuff, you're not going to get that stuff off. It's not like plywood; it's bolted up on there in metal.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like the HUD windows too back in the day when they bolted them on. And the problem is not so much getting in; it's when we're in there and we got to get out.
That's the problem.
I think we have to kind of differentiate between a vacant building and an unoccupied. Hmm. And realtors are doing that nowadays. They're making them so secure. It's not a really vacant building. It's just kind of a transient building where nobody's living in it yet, but will. And they board those things up, and the problem is once we get in, you know, the entrance you went in isn't available anymore. How do you get out? Well, now, how do you get out? Because these things are boarded up, they're bolted. And it's another problem that you're starting to see across the country.
Right.
Again, not vacant, but just happened to be unoccupied at that moment in time.
Good point, unoccupied or vacant. Before we leave, we've got one more question here we want to get on. And Chief Mullins, if you can, you call it the McMansions. Can you just shed a little light on that? And I know that was a terminology that I had never heard before. And I'm sure that there's a lot more firefighters out there that are in the same position that I was in. When I heard McMansions, I was like, is that something new that McDonald's has got at their window?
But, no, but I think it's taken kind of from McDonald's. McMansions are single-family detached houses. They're typically 3,000 and maybe 5,000 square foot over that. They're just a huge house. And then the ones we're not
used to. Mansions and McMansions.
It's named a mansion. And McMansion is because basically it's like putting together a quarter pounder with cheese. You know, you've got all the components there. All you got to do is put them together. Now, when you look at these houses being constructed, they come in on a flatbed, and all they have to do is put the stuff, basically put it right where it needs to go, and nail it to the floor, and then put the next platform on and go from there. So basically, they're popping up all over the place, kind of like McDonald's, and then they're really relatively easy to put together. But we're seeing a lot of problems with them because they're large. They have lightweight building components. And once again, going back to what you were saying earlier, we're not fighting the same fires we did 20, 30 years ago because the components we have in the house, other than being lightweight, everything is made of plastics, and plastics are burning at twice the BTU rate that a typical Class A combustibles are. So, you know, we're becoming overwhelmed by these structures because they're so big and they're just, you know, getting beyond our capacity to put them out.
And that's another point. As an engine company with staffing, that's what we were talking about here at the beginning was the staffing. Once we start reducing staffing, and now we're going into structures that are two, three, sometimes even four or five times larger homes than what we're normally getting into, the area that we have to cover is enlarged greatly, and our numbers are decreasing, so we're not able to get in there as quickly and probably get to the seat of the fire or to the area of origin as quickly as we'd like to, would these houses being as big as they are?
Very much so. Plus, I think there's a great potential for failure in these structures. So if we're not getting in there in a timely manner, if we're not getting water on the fire, especially in the attic areas and the basement areas that are unprotected, these buildings are going to fall down.
I know last year, right after the expo, Montgomery County, Maryland Fire Department had a couple of fires where firefighters got inside, and because of lightweight construction, the floors gave out on them, and they ended up, fortunately on their end, the firefighters didn't lose their lives. They were some with severe burns and were in the hospital for a great length of time. But that's one of the things that, again, as a company officer, I try to tell my guys when we're out driving around, look at what's going on. If you see any type of construction work, whether it's remodeling going on or new construction going up, stop, get nosy, ask questions, walk around, because chances are we're going to find ourselves back in that building, especially in a renovated building. You're looking at a building that was built back in the 30s, and now they're doing renovations, and there a lot of the renovation work is with lightweight construction.
Yes.
And we're not going to be thinking that process when we pull up in front of that structure. We're going to be thinking conventional structure materials in there, when in reality there's been rework been done and lightweight materials have been used. So use extreme caution. Be nosy, ask questions, and see what's going on.
Yeah, one of the things with the McMansions, and I just recently went with some of my friends from my volley department, because we have some up by us. They're like small hotels. Some of them are 7, 8 bedrooms. They're just enormous. And we were looking at one that was under construction, and the construction stopped, I guess, because of the economy. Lightweight wood trusses, TGI beams in the basement. And the other thing that we noticed, and I don't know if this is across the country, but at least in North Jersey, a lot of these McMansions, you go through a gate, and the houses are 100, 150 yards away. They sit way back off the street, far from the nearest fire hydrant, number one. And we were looking at some of the windows that were in, and every window in this McMansion we looked at was triple-pane energy-efficient windows. I mean, so when you talk about two-man engine companies, I mean, who's going to take that triple? Because the energy-efficient window does its job.
Out
all the
heat's
going to be in there until you open the front door. But the other thing that I noticed, again, and just talking to some of my friends around the country, we pull up to these structures, all right, and we have the reduced manpower, we have less companies, But we tend to use the same strategy and tactics on a McMansion
yes,
as we use
exactly.
on a Cape Cod, as a 2.5-story frame, and a ranch. We really, you know, everybody out there's got to take a hard look at this and really need to change your strategy and tactics. And that comes through pre-planning and knowing what's going on in the community. Because you can't fight these things like you would in a normal house. They're way beyond that, way beyond it.
Absolutely right. So I guess what we're getting ready to wrap up here. Our time is getting short, and we've learned a lot here about what, as firefighters, as company officers, as chief officers, we're looking at what are we really being put up against here with manpower reductions, with staffing. We talked about some equipment that we can use as a tool on our trucks, the Blitz nozzles, the mercury nozzles, things of that nature there can help us out. But again, life safety is going to be our first thing that we should be thinking about, and obviously it's the firefighter's safety before all the other things come in there. So again, some great points were brought up here today. I just want to go around to the panel one last time and ask if they've got any final thoughts or comments that they would like to make before we wrap it up. So Ryan, why don't you lead us off here in closing comments?
First I'd like to thank the panel for inviting me. It's just a true honor to sit with you guys on the panel today. And I'd like to encourage all the listeners, all you firefighters out there to, my wise captain says, get up out the lazy boy and get on the apparatus floor. I challenge each one of you to become a true professional at your trade. Find the tool that you're not familiar with, get familiar with it. Reduced staffing is going to put us all in jeopardy, and you just got to be that much better at your job. So let's get out there, let's get back to the basics, let's learn about our constructions, learn about our tools, and let's just be safe.
Chief Mullen.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think especially the point about the engine companies, and basically I think that was the main impetus behind what we're talking about today. The engine companies are a workhorse of the fire service. Obviously, you need the trucks, you need the squads, you need everybody else, but 90% of the time, the engine companies are doing a lot of the work out there, and they're the ones that are going to be out there in first doing, taking command and initiating operations in these buildings. So it really behooves the troops on the engine companies to get out there and take a look at these places, and then also, like Ryan said, be proficient at their jobs. And also, I'd just like to say thank you to Chief Cobb, because if anybody doesn't know, Chief Cobb was a member of the armed forces, and he served in Vietnam, and I think that's a very commendable thing, and I appreciate his service to the country.
Thank you.
Helicopter pilot, right?
No, I was flying in it. Let somebody else handle that.
Chief Cobb, your final comments?
Yeah, you know what? Things are changing. Building construction, size of the buildings, the resources that we have are changing, and now in the economic times, they're not getting any better, they're getting worse. And I think every chief out there, every company officer out there has to really take a hard look. You may have to do a complete reevaluation of your strategy and tactics. You know what, if we're really serious about killing less firefighters and injuring less, I think 38,700 firefighters got injured last year on the fire ground, just on the fire ground. If we're serious about lowering that and lowering the death rate, we really got to take a hard look. I mean, if we're going to be forced to do more with less, we really got to take a look at our strategy and tactics. Kidding around the other day, talking about engine operations, I said to a guy, I said, you know what? They're cutting your department back to two-man engine companies. You better get really proficient on the thing that sticks up in the middle of your engine called the Stang or the pre-mounted deck gun, because right. You're going to have to use it a lot more. But everybody, you know what? Everybody just needs to take a real hard look at what's going on nowadays. We can't continue to fight fires now with two-man crews or less when we were doing it with four and five. You can't do the same thing. Something's got to give.
It certainly does. My final thoughts and comments on it are that, again, knowing your jurisdictions and knowing what's going on within your response districts is going to be key to successful operations as a company officer, as a chief officer, getting out and surveying, asking those questions, seeing what's going on, how is the construction being done, what type of hazards do we have, and make sure that information is passed on. Communications, I think, in the fire service today is lacking. Ryan brought it up here that he likes the idea of the email system and everything like that. Well, those systems are great, but do you have a policy in place as to what you expect out of your email system? One of the things that I found is the email system is we've got an email for our company, not for our individual firefighters or individual officers. And what I find quite a bit is people ask about an email that was sent, and it's like, yeah, I never saw it. And the reason I didn't see it is because somebody deleted it before I came in the shift. So, if we've got those kind of communications out there, we've got to have policies backing them up as to what we expect them to do for us and how we expect them to work. But communications is going to be key to success. I would like to thank everybody for being on the panel here today. I know there was a lot of things that we covered. Some of the things that we were talking about here are staffing. We were talking about SOGs with vacant structures. And we also talked about the McMansions. I hope all of the stuff that we talked about here with our panelists. Chief Mullen, I'd like to thank you. Chief Cobb, I'd like to thank you. And Firefighter Pennington, I'd like to thank you for sitting in here. I know it was a last-minute thing for you, and it's grateful that you were able to sit in here because you bring another perspective to the table. I always like to get opinions from different areas and segments because a lot of times you just hear from the chief's office on down, and sometimes a lot of good information is deciphered at the lower levels and in the lower ranks, yet for whatever reason, whether the individual firefighter is a little bit timid or shy and doesn't want to get that information back up through, or whatever the reason might be, I think that we need to listen to everybody at all facets of the fire service, not just from the chief's office down, because sometimes, again, my opinions, and I know my opinions can get me in trouble at times, but my opinion is that sometimes they're so far removed from what's going on out there on the streets that they need the wake-up call once in a while as well. So
I think you'd all join me, too, in thanking Pete Matthews and his crew at firehouse.com for putting on presentations like this. As Dr. O'Neill said in the opening on Wednesday, you can learn the easy way and you can learn the hard way. This is the easy way. We're given, the four of us were given opinions based on a lot of years. So I kind of consider learning the easy way as with firehouse.com and Pete Matthews is doing with their podcast. So I want to thank all of them for giving us the opportunity, too.
And I concur with those words as well, Chief. I like to thank Pete Matthews. It's been a great opportunity for me. He's given me some great opportunities. And you make another good point there, too. You can learn the hard way or you can learn the easy way. This is being one of the
very
easy ways.
Very good point. Hmm.
I try to tell my firefighters that work for me, I have an open-door policy. I love the fire service. I love to talk about the fire service. I love to talk strategies and tactics. Those, I think, are one of my strongest points. And I would just ask them to, hey, the door's open. Come on down, sit in the office. I'll talk for hours on end about things, but, take the initiative. We'll do our 1 hour of training, a shift or whatever, but the door's always open to talk more because that's the way I learned. And sitting on panels with Chief Cobb, Chief Mullins, Firefighter Pennington, and others in the career, just picking their brains and seeing what it's about. Just before we came on, I'll add one more comment here. Just before we came on, Chief Mullen and I were talking about networking, and the successes and the key successes for networking are being able to know people in different areas of the, not just in the fire service, but in different areas of the community service, that if something comes up, you haven't seen that problem before, if you're into a networking system where you've got contact people, you can email, telephone call, whatever it might be, you can have answers to those questions in just short periods of time. It's something that you don't have to browbeat the thing for a long period of time to try and find an answer yourself. Networking is a wonderful thing. There's people out there with the answers. So, gentlemen, I would like to thank you. I'd like to thank everybody that was here today. Firehouse.com, Firehouse Magazine, for allowing us to put this podcast on for everybody. And again, if you have any questions, if you want to get a hold of any of us, I'm sure our information is out there, and we'd love to hear from anybody. I guess that's it for today, folks. Thank you for coming to Firehouse Expo.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.